Good morning. There's a lot of banter at the place where I work. I like it. I think it's a good thing. It's good for fraternity. It's good for camaraderie. It keeps you on your toes mentally. As is the nature of banter, a lot of it is responding to what's ever going on in front of you, so most of it is sort of ad lib. But as you work with the same people for years and years, you begin to develop your own vocabulary and your own stock phrases for when the same thing in theme happens again and again. There's some phrase that you can call on that will remind all who are listening that, yes, this is just like the last 23 times this happened, and when are we going to push on through this? And one such phrase that's employed that way is the phrase that actually has quite a lot of spiritual weight to it, or can have in application, the phrase that's used, certified but not qualified. And let me explain where that phrase comes from. I think all of you know I work at the Linear Accelerator Center, SLAC, just a couple of miles from here, and it's quite a unique environment. There's a lot of heavy machinery. It's a very unique place to work as a synchrotron particle accelerator, and as a consequence, of course, there's a lot of hazards that go along with that situation. In fact, as you drive in, one of the signs by the road says simply, as a sort of legal coverall, unique hazards may exist. And I'm never too sure whether that's referring to the staff or the actual machinery, but every time I see that sign, I look at it, it says unique hazards may exist, and I think, yeah, I know, I go to lunch with them every day. But anyway, part of the reason that there are hazards is because of the nature of it being a radiation facility. It's part of our job to generate ionizing radiation, and that's dangerous in its own sense. In addition to that, there's also radioactive materials on site. In addition to that, there's also very high voltage on site, and occasionally coupled with lethal current levels. You can also find furnaces with very high temperatures, and you can also find liquid nitrogen, which is very low temperatures, dangerously so. So there really is, you know, if you're not too sure of how to interact with the universe around you, you can injure yourself in an exciting array of novel and interesting ways on the SLAC site. And for that reason, therefore, it becomes understandable there's a lot of safety training. Every time you want to touch this piece of equipment or that bit of equipment, heavy crane or a forklift or whatever, and all the other things, there's training that's associated with it. And the idea is that the training should give you the best possible chance of staying safe and not injuring yourself or injuring somebody else. Makes obvious sense. The only difficulty with that, and it's unavoidable, becomes, if you're not careful, there tends to be a philosophy developed that anyone who's done the safety training must of necessity be safe. And anyone who hasn't done the safety training must of necessity be unsafe. And as you know, in real life, that's just not true at all. There are people who are intrinsically careful and level-headed, and whether they've done training or not would probably be okay. The safety training is still a good idea, gives them, you know, an extra few percent chance of staying safe. And contrarily, there are people who are just not well skilled at interacting with the universe in general, and all the safety training in the world really isn't going to help that much. Again, it might boost their chances by a few percent, but they're coming from a pretty low baseline. And so it's in cases like these that you can look around the lab, and occasionally you'll see someone, you know, perhaps you'll see a high-pressure liquid nitrogen line flailing around like a demented snake and people running for cover as minus 200 Celsius liquid is spraying around. And it's in those cases that some of the staff, and one in particular that I can think of, would look around and roll his eyes and just say, certified but not qualified. And you understand what that means. And so therefore, while safety training is always important, it's important in that universe, and it translates very naturally into the spiritual universe, that you can't hold up a certificate to prove anything about who you are. I mean, technically, I have a business card to prove that I'm a scientist. But this business card doesn't really prove that I'm a scientist. If I behave in a foolish manner that destroys the lab, there's no point in me resorting to the business card and saying, yes, but I really am a professional physicist. In fact, that just increases my culpability, not rather than actually denying the fact that I made a mistake. And unfortunately, that whole principle, certified but not qualified, translates very naturally onto the life of King Saul, perhaps more so than any other of the characters in the Bible. King Saul's life is little more than a tragedy, and it's a tragedy because he is certified and chosen and appointed and anointed to be the leader of God's kingdom, to be God's king. But as the chapters roll by, you realize that he is ever less qualified for that position. In fact, the book of 1 Samuel, a very favorite book of mine, I love it, the book of 1 Samuel is a book which presents Saul and David, those two men more so than any other, and tragically, for Saul at least, often those two men are presented in counterpoint to each other. There is a man of the flesh, who is Saul, and there is a man of the spirit, who is David. And in some mitigation to Saul, he never really wanted to be king in the first place. In fact, his tragic life and his tragic kingship was born out of a separate tragedy that the people wanted a king in the first place. There's a lot of scriptures in this morning, and we're not going to turn them all up, but perhaps we could turn this one up because it's worth looking at the text in detail here. 1 Samuel chapter 8, and this is the point where the Israelite people ask for a king. I'm going to jump in at verse 4, and it says this: "All the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah. They said to him, 'You are old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint a king to lead us, such as all the other nations have.'" And you ask yourself, why did they want a king? Now, if we read that verse again and look at it closely, there's really only one major reason given. It's because Samuel's children are not godly men. They actually mention, as seemingly as an aside, "Oh, and by the way, all the other nations have a king too." That's kind of tacked on as a side. But if you read verses 4 and 5, their reason to ask for a king is seemingly this very noble reason of wanting truth and justice and good leaders and the Israelite way, or whatever they would have said back then. And yet I don't think they're being truthful. And what gives away the fact that they're probably lying is you can look down to verses 19 and 20. Because Samuel gives them all God's reasons of why them choosing a king is a bad idea and a rejection of him. And they come back in verse 19, "But the people refused to listen to Samuel. No, they said, 'We want a king over us. Then we will be like all the other nations, with a king to lead us and go out before us and fight our battles.'" And you think to yourself, well, hang on a minute. I thought the reason you wanted a king was all about having a just leader and not Samuel's sons who were ungodly. You see, that reason has fallen by the wayside. I don't think that was at the heart of what they wanted at all. What started off as just an aside, a sort of casual little, "Ooh, and wouldn't it be nice, we'd be like the other nations as well," in verse 5, becomes the only core reason left as the argument continues in verses 19 and 20. That is why they wanted a king. They wanted to be like everyone else. They wanted the approbation of their peers. That was desperately important to them. All the other nations had a king, so they needed a king, else they wouldn't be a proper nation. Never mind their eyes or God's eyes, in the eyes of their peers, the peer nations, they wouldn't be a proper nation unless they too had a king. And so what they were drawing on, and what is a true fact, is the best way to earn other people's approval is to mimic them. Tell them their ideas are sound and good. Adopt their religion, adopt their practices, adopt all their points of view. And then the people will say, "Wow, you're really clever. Yes, you're one of us." And you'll earn approval that way. And that's what God's people wanted to do when they were surrounded by other people who were ungodly around them. And that risk was true and valid in 1 Samuel chapter 8. And I suggest to you, it's one of the points we need to take away as points of encouragement today. Today, the situation is exactly the same. You are now living in a society, and there are different societies around the world, but there are societies now on which particular issues will come up. And if you want to be approved of, you claim the popular position. And because everyone likes being approved of, it's very tempting to want to support all of those popular positions so that people like us and we become popular. But that was the challenge faced back in 1 Samuel 8, and it's the challenge faced in February 2012. You have to actually stand up for what God wants. And yes, you might look a bit silly and you might look a bit strange. And what's your nation doing? You don't even have a king. What a rabble you are, just trekking around the wilderness and booting people out of their land. But that's what God wanted, for them to have him as their king, even though he was not a king of flesh or a king that could be seen. And he warned them, if you take a king like the other nations, it'll end up being essentially a huge taxation on all your resources. That's what Samuel explains in 1 Samuel 8. Nehemiah goes even further to suggest it would actually be a return to slavery. But let's think about that phrase we introduced, certified but not qualified. Was Saul really God's king, or was he actually an enemy to God's kingdom? Now, was he really God's king? For sure. He had the best certification going. He had been anointed by none other than the prophet Samuel. Prophet Samuel wasn't just a big name. He was the big name, the leader in Israel, so much revered so much that if he came to a village unexpectedly, the people were afraid and would bring him out an offering. That happened more than once. And this is the man who said, "This man Saul, son of Kish, of the tribe of Benjamin, he shall be your king." That was his certification. But what was his character and what was his conduct? And perhaps you'll forgive me. Come with me just for another little anecdote of... This is one of the best ways that I remember a principle. It just burned its way into my mind many years ago, and I'll share with you a little story by which it happened. We're going to go back to England, and it's somewhere in the late 1980s, and it's about 10 o'clock at night, and since you're not an English audience, I will bother to point out to you, it is, of course, raining. See, if you were English, I wouldn't need to say that, but... You live in a land where you don't have to expect to nearly drown each day as you walk to your car. And it was raining in a way that only England can. There's a variety of different types of rain. I've traveled a lot around the world, and it's not the most intense. I've been in Asian monsoons. They're definitely the most intense. But sometimes it rains in England as if it's just not even trying. I mean, to say it's half-hearted would be an over-compliment. It's more sort of quarter-hearted or an eighth or so. It's more than spitting, but it's just everyone in England is bored of the rain, and yet sometimes it rains as if the rain is bored of itself. It just sort of dribbles out of the sky without really bothering. And so it's an extremely depressing situation. Anyway, that's not relevant to the story. Sorry. I just got off on a bit of a rant there. So there's about three of us, and it's about this time of year, maybe March, and we've just been out for the evening, we've had dinner, and we've had a glass of beer, and we're walking home, and... We're roommates, college roommates, and we're planning something for April Fool's Day, which we won't go into here, but we have a plan for which we're going to need a fair few traffic cones. That's what we need. And as we're walking home, there just happens to be just one traffic cone, three of us, but there's just one traffic cone by the side of the road. It seems to be guarding this pothole, which is about an eighth of an inch deep, so it's really not that tragic. But anyway, so I think, oh... Splendid, we'll have that, so we need that. So picked up the traffic cone, and I'm wandering on home. Well, I've barely walked 30 yards before a police car pulls up. And the policeman, seemingly most unamused, says to me, "Look, put that traffic cone's there for a reason, lad. Go put it back and stop being such a fool." And his language was actually worse than that, but you don't need to hear that repeated up here. But... it was relevant. I need to tell you that it was quite extreme language, because that's what shocked me. It was like, I was surprised by that, because I was thinking, I mean, clearly I was culpable of everything. I was in the wrong 100%, but I was thinking policemen in England, actually much like the United States, are generally really professional. And their job, in a nutshell, one paraphrase would be to say, is to come in on an inflamed situation and calm it down. And they're generally pretty good at that. So to take a relatively calm situation and try and inflame it, I was surprised. I was taken aback. So I thought, okay. So I wandered back 30 yards, put the traffic cone back where it had come from, and I thought, well, I'll just engage in a little verbal sword fighting with this chap, and, you know, what could possibly go wrong? So I thought, I know what I'll say. I'll just say to him, so I'll put the traffic cone back. By the way, I'm not a fool. I'll just throw that out. That's all I need. Because all he can do is either sink into this pantomime level of, oh, yes, you are, in which case he's lost, or he has to agree with me, in which case he's lost. I can't lose, I thought. But it turned out this police officer was something of a Zen master, and he was not unduly fazed by an arrogant 18-year-old who wrongly supposed that he was clever. So I went up to the police car and said, oh, put the cone back just like you wanted. By the way, I'm not actually a fool. And he looked at me with a calmness that belied that he was more than ready for this. And he looked at me and he just said simply, "No," he said, "you're not. It's just that you do everything that a fool would do." Now, I know enough to know when I'm beaten, so I laughed. He smiled. I went home. All was well. But what a wonderful principle. What a wonderful principle. We can claim whatever we want, but it's what we do that proves what we are. And that was the principle that he gave me, and I'm very grateful to him. I can't even remember what his face looks like. But it was a wonderful, wonderful lesson that I've carried with me ever since. And I've used it to assess my peers as scientists, my peers as Christians, as disciples. I don't mind what you call yourself. I'm just going to watch what you do. Because that's what that officer had taught me. Was Saul God's king? Well, what does God's king do? Luckily, God tells us, so we don't have to deduce it for ourselves. The Spirit of the Lord will rest on God's king, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and might, the Spirit of knowledge and of the fear of the Lord. And he will delight in the fear of the Lord. He will not judge by what he sees with his eyes, or decide by what he hears with his ears. But with righteousness he will judge the needy. With justice he will give decisions for the poor of the earth. That's what God's king will do. What then does Saul do? Well, that's why we took that reading from 1 Samuel 22, and whether you have it open in front of you or not, you can probably recall from memory just a few of the things that Saul was doing. He was engaged in the pursuit of David, God's anointed, with the intention to kill him. That's not really what God's king should be doing. Furthermore, he'd actually seconded the entire national army to participate in his own personal agenda against David at such a time when the land was under attack from the Philistines, both from the south and from the western seaboard. And as we see in that chapter, he even goes so far as to order the slaughter of the priests. The priests, whose job it was to represent God to the people, are ordered murdered by the king, King Saul. And even though the noble Israelite soldiers won't do it, there's a foreigner there, an Edomite, who will and does. So Saul can argue, "I'm not an enemy of God's kingdom. In fact, I'm the king." And any Zen masters disguised as traffic cops are in the vicinity would answer, "No, you're not an enemy. It's just that you do everything that an enemy of God's kingdom would do." And that's perhaps a good way to come to an understanding both of who King Saul is and who you and I can be. We might claim to be members of God's kingdom. We've certified ourselves, haven't we, in baptism. We've opened a covenant relationship. We have a membership at 1536 James Avenue, and more broadly, in a sense, in a group. And yet that's our certification. What do we actually do? Because that will show who we actually are. We'll come to finish up on thinking about ourselves at the end, but just maybe a couple more words just thinking about who the Word of God shows us that Saul is. Does anyone remember the rather odd story that's the first story we're ever told about Saul? Any thoughts? Oh, the one before that. His father's donkeys were lost. And the story actually kind of goes on and on. It extends for a couple of chapters. And you think, wow, why would such a trivial event be recorded for eternal history in the pages of the Word of God that there were some donkeys missing? And this man couldn't find them. But that's how you first meet Saul. He's a man who cannot complete the task that his father has given him to do. And I think that's the lesson we're supposed to see there. It was a simple task. Go find the donkeys. And if you actually bother to read those two chapters, that would be 1 Samuel 9 and 10, you'll see that, and I'm not trying to be funny, but Saul does a hopelessly bad job. It's not just that he can't find the donkeys. Someone else who wasn't tasked to find the donkeys does find the donkeys. And we learn later that Samuel knows that the donkeys have been found, but Saul doesn't. And by the time he gets home, he is actually not only has failed to find the donkeys, but he's the last person to learn that the donkeys have been found by someone else. I mean, it's a spectacular failure over something that seems trivial. And yet, what was the underlying principle? Your father gave you an instruction. Your father gave you a job to do, and you failed most miserably. As the book unfolds, you'll see that Saul stops hunting donkeys, and he starts, wrongly, hunting David. And his success rate is exactly the same. He can't find David. At one point, his own daughter makes a dummy in the bed, and David's gone over the wall during the night. Saul arrives and arrests the dummy, and whoops, wrong, missed again. He cannot find David any more than he can find the donkeys. Ironically, there's another occasion, again, it's almost comedy, they're both on the same mountain, and Saul's on one side of the mountain, and David's just round the back. It's almost running around like a comedy scene. Saul can't get him. By contrast, David can find Saul whenever he wants, and on two separate occasions, steals up close enough to touch Saul while Saul is asleep or not paying attention. So there's that contrast coming out again. I think it's an important theme we're supposed to know about this man. Look, you kind of wonder, I wonder if the donkeys had done the same thing, you know, snuck up on him in the night and tapped him on the shoulder and run off with his spear and water jug or whatever. Probably not, but, you know, it's the picture you're given to think of. Why is that important? Perhaps in what it blossoms into. Saul ultimately is the man who can't find God. He can't find the donkeys. He can't find David. He cannot find God. And even, let me read to you a couple of verses. God actually explicitly refuses to converse with Saul, even when he asks for him. Saul asked God, "Shall I go down after the Philistines? Will you give them into Israel's hand?" But God did not answer him that day. And that's not a lone verse. It goes on in that vein. And in fact, it goes on all the way until the day or the night before Saul dies. Before he goes to Endor. Saul inquired of the Lord, but the Lord did not answer Saul by dreams or Urim or prophets. So you can see Saul has tried all three different ways of trying to find God. And that verse is quite poignant. But God cannot be found by Saul. And the reason God cannot be found by Saul is that one needs to have God's character before any form of connection with him is possible. And I think that's the main lesson that's taught in the life of King Saul. The man who couldn't find the donkeys, couldn't find David, and couldn't find God. A man who couldn't connect with his father's instructions, either his physical father, Kish, or his spiritual father. But of course, the most important question that comes to me, I'm not here to teach history about King Saul, I'm here to examine myself, and you're here to examine yourselves as disciples, as one born of God. Am I born of God? Well, I'm certified. My baptismal date is recorded. And irony of ironies, I even have a business card, which comes from the Williamsburg Christadelphian Foundation just for our email addresses. So technically, I even have a business card to prove I'm a disciple. Well, is that what proof is that? None at all. The question is, what do I do? How do you know me? What's your vision of me? Because what your vision of me is a much more categoric description of who I am, because you formed that vision based on what you've seen. And as much as that affects who I really am, that's true for you too. Who do your friends know you as? Do they know you as the thinker, the joker, the clown, the man or the woman of God? What's the first thing, if that was a multiple choice question, what's the first thing they'd select? That's who you are. And if you want to change that, if you think they've given the wrong answer, then you'll need to pay more attention to the answer you'll have wanted them to give in what you do and what they see to make that real. There's one verse we can turn to. I think it's a good idea. It's right at the end of the New Testament, 1 John 3. And this really underscores, hopefully, some validity to what I'm saying. I don't want it to just hang out as my own personal hypothesis. Because we could still argue, look, I've been baptized, I've entered covenant relationship with the Lord, therefore I am a son of God, and I will always be a son of God. And there's truth to that. But there's also truth to the opposite. Look at verses 9 and 10. No one who is born of God will sin. God's seed remains in him. He cannot sin because he has been born of God. I remember that verse in the Old King James. He that is born of God cannot sin, I think is what it says very simply. He that is born of God cannot sin. So, am I born of God? Absolutely, I think. Do I sin? Absolutely. So I'm not born of God. You see, this verse isn't trying to contradict the rest of Scripture. It's explaining that idea of certified but not qualified. It's giving the notion that actually being born of God is a transient state that you'll arrive in and that you'll slip out of, and that you'll arrive in and that you'll slip out of. You may have entered a covenant relationship with God, but you are not worthy of that covenant when you've slipped into a state, you're denying that birth when we behave in a way that disgraces that state. Am I beginning to preach the idea of salvation by works, the idea that you can be a child of God if you do all the right things and be a jolly good chap? No, of course not, because I'd be a fool to say that. We know very clearly that the Bible says you are saved by grace, not of works, so that none of you can boast. You are saved by grace through faith. So it's that belief that must be maintained. It's that belief that must be maintained. Without faith, it is impossible to please God. And that's the theme of Hebrews 11. And so this is the last point I want to come to where we can tie it off. And it will be in that famous chapter, that catalogue of the faithful in Hebrews 11. And before you turn it up, because you might want to turn it up at some point, but before, unless you're already there, just a question, and I appreciate I've asked this question before, but hopefully you've all forgotten. So, does anyone remember, in that catalogue of the faithful, remember by faith X did this, by faith Y did that, do you remember who comes first at the top of the list? Silence.
Abel comes first, because you rightly pointed out the writer and those who are faithful. Come
right. Abel is the most common answer given. Hebrews 11 verse 4, by faith Abel did whatever he did. And the others come next. And it seems to be even a chronological recount through Abraham, through Moses. But it's not the right answer. Actually, Hebrews 11 verse 3 has one directly before it. And it says, oh, and I'm not there. Look at that. I'm not even ready for my own talk. Thanks, Millie. Yes, that's right. By faith we understand that the universe was formed at God's command, so that what is seen was not made out of what was visible. So God is kind enough and has honored us enough to put us at the very top of the list of that catalogue of the faithful. And that's an invisible verse. So many people read it and don't see it. But you don't get to be there for free. There is a condition. Not by faith everyone is the best. By faith we understand that the universe was formed at God's command. Those who believe that God made the world and that it didn't evolve out of its own components are those who are placed at the head of the list of the catalogue of the faithful. That's an interesting condition, isn't it? I don't know if you got there in your class this morning, Art. I had to step out halfway through. But that's, you know, that I think is a very strengthening point to the argument you were making this morning, Art, that perhaps God knew that it would eventually, there would come a time when it would be the hardest thing of all to believe that God made the world. Remember back in the day, you only had to go back 400 years, everyone believed the sun went round the earth, not the earth round the sun. The evidence for that was extremely strong. You take you out into a field and you stand in the field and the field does not appear to be moving and you watch the sun traverse from east to west, the evidence is virtually conclusive that the sun goes round the earth. And you'd be ridiculed, or worse, if you suggested differently. And yet today, it's fascinating. You'd be laughed at if you thought the sun went round the earth. And yet I suggest to you that less than 1% of the population, if I took them out into a field and said, okay, we're standing in the field doesn't appear to be moving, there goes the sun, prove to me scientifically that the earth is going round the sun. I think less than 1% of the population could do it. And yet we all believe it. That's why we know belief doesn't come from the evidence in front of our eyes. It comes often from copying everyone around us. And maybe God knew in Hebrews 11, there will come a time when you'll just want to copy everyone around you and say, yeah, the earth grew out of all the bits around it. And God said, you know what? You can be at the top of my list of the faithful if you can stand against what seems to be, just like standing in that field and watching the sun move, common sense convinces you the earth goes round the sun. Common sense is not always a reliable thing. And that's the promise that God gives to us, to stay faithful, not to say, give us a king so that we can be like the other nations, but to actually stay faithful to the things that he's explained to us right from the very beginning. Poor King Saul was not able to do that, but I hope and pray that each and every one of you can. And I pray a blessing on you this week to that end. Thank you.